ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
One of Australia's most recognisable broadcasters is facing the biggest battle of his life. Alan Jones has pleaded not guilty to multiple historical sexual assault charges, and now the case is before the courts.
I'm not going to dwell here on the allegations made about me, other than to say that I refute them entirely.
As witnesses step into the box and the evidence unfolds, the Case of podcast will be your eyes and ears inside the courtroom. Search the Case of podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
East Coast clowns or a costly mistake? A mighty stoush has again emerged between the states and territories following the release of the Productivity Commission's interim report on WA's sweetheart GST deal. Meanwhile, as Parliament returns for another sitting week, Labor says it's confident it will pass its NDIS overhaul with the support of the Coalition. But while the Albanese government says it isn't contemplating delays, states and territories are warning about gaps in care. And superannuation is back in lights as an ideological battleground. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Karvelis.
And I'm Jacob Grieber.
And Jacob, what a time to be alive. The old hits are back. Federation-focused episode today. The states and territories and Commonwealth stoushes, iconic schemes like the superannuation, the NDIS and its cuts, a national yet not so national gun buyback scheme. I mean, really, what a time to be alive.
There's quite a bit going on, isn't there? But the fun thing is we get to remind ourselves that we are indeed a federation.
We do.
Which not every country is, and it has its own little uniqueness, doesn't it? Challenges, political, these sort of fracture lines and ways of doing things that we do to this day that are results of a bunch of bearded old fellas in the 1890s sort of designing this federation that we live
in. Yeah, and that original design and its quirks have come back to hit us hard, really, in some ways. Sometimes we love those quirks, other times we find them infuriating. There is kind of a lot of politics today as well. I mean, it is Monday, and shout out to our listener, Nicholas, who suggested we rename Monday's episodes to Politics Now. Get it? Politics Now. I loved it, can I say? No one loved it more than our producer, Lara, who basically has constructed an entire podcast around that joke.
That's because both of you are tragic dad joke lovers.
See, it just shows the gendering of jokes must be broken, because I know a lot of lame women who like lame jokes too, me being the president. All right, let's get into the lamest joke of it all, and that's the WA GST deal. Boom, boom!
That was good.
Oh, my God, thank you. Okay, on Friday, the Productivity Commission released its interim report on the deal. Don't allow yourself to fall into a coma, because it's actually spicy stuff, okay? The Productivity Commission labelled the 2018 GST deal that Scott Morrison presided over and Anthony Albanese embraced as if it was his own child, right? The West Australian deal being a costly mistake. And Jacob, whoa, the response from the West, which we I'm sure they had been preparing the attack lines before, the ink had dried on the report, because this is a fixed position from them. What was it?
Well, they went into full, you know, ding-dong mode straight away. The Premier was on his feet calling the Productivity Commission's authors, who are a bunch of economists. They're not political players. These are the nerdiest of the nerds that you can imagine, calling them a bunch of East Coast clowns, and that the whole thing was somehow an attack on WA. I think it's very interesting. We can get into the detail, but when you go ad hominem or you accuse the report's authors of having some sort of bias, I feel like you're already a long way behind in the argument. You're not tackling the actual argument itself. You're just going after the motivations or otherwise of the people who've written the report. And I think that's actually a sign of weakness in this debate, not strength. Happy to be contradicted on that, but I think when you go full ding dong rather than into the detail of why the report's wrong, yep, yeah, you're already on the back foot.
I couldn't agree with you more. Like, absolutely. The full ding-dong tells the story, right? Even the language. Yeah, okay, you get a headline, but East Coast clowns, you know. The politics of leaning into those idiots on the East Coast, the sort of Wild West fantasist construction, and you might be listening to this, by the way, in Perth, in Western Australia. We do have listeners everywhere, obviously. By the way, I freaking love WA. It's a really amazing place. But the kind of us and them stuff, I will just tell you what I think. I don't like it. Like, we're one country and it's sometimes very divisive, actually. And you find, and it's absolutely bipartisan over there, like whether it's Labor or Liberal. So this is not politics, mate. It's the politics of tribalism in Australia. You know, we're from the West, you're from the East, and I know you can't break all of it, but some of the perversions when it comes to the way we design policy, the idea that because they can have a boom because of the resources that happen to be geographically placed to where they are, we are one nation, right? Like, we are one country is what I mean. I didn't mean the, you know, political party there. So GST, just to explain, it's collected by the federal government, and then it's split among the states and territories. It's split based on need rather than by person. So that is for all sorts of reasons, good reasons, like in WA. They should get a higher proportion of some of the GST because they have so many remote Aboriginal communities. You try and service those communities compared to metropolitan centres like Melbourne. So there are some good reasons for distributions being not exactly, you know, value for one person versus dollar. It's not just population based, right, Jacob? But this particular deal has already cost the federal budget $23 billion in its first 6 years. And that's staggering, isn't it? Like, it's way more disproportionate than even what they thought they were designing. And they knew they were already designing something bad, I think.
Yeah, and the more problematic part of all of this is to pay for the deal, the Commonwealth every year, because we're still in a deficit, every year the Commonwealth government borrows money to fund this arrangement. From consolidated revenue, which, because we're in a structural deficit, they are literally borrowing the money to do this. So it's an extraordinary situation. The Productivity Commission report calculates that the amount of money that's gone to WA, in addition to what its needs are, according to its calculations, would be the equivalent of giving everyone else in the country a $450 income tax cut. And that's a really neat way of pointing out that this is being funded to a large extent, because of the way the tax system works, from income taxes. That is a tax on every single worker around the country. So when you hear you're right to call it, I think, the sort of division between East and West, that's what it actually means in dollar terms. And there's a lot of interesting stuff in that report. I think people should have a read of it. It really breaks down the way the system works. It talks about the history of it. But what it won't do is tell you the politics, and because they're nerds, they're not political analysts, but politics drives this thing and always has. WA was a net recipient of income and assets and wealth from the rest of the country for really best part of 100 years. Then along comes the China boom at pretty much the same time as the GST gets introduced, and that's revenue that goes to the states. So it has to be divided according to the same principle as everything else is divided. Then you get the mining boom. WA does have to invest more in its economy, in the way its infrastructure works, to get that mining boom working. And so this argument took off. And the politics, of course, was driven really through that sort of second half of the coalition government, definitely in 2019. As you say, the Prime Minister embraced this deal as if it were his own child. And guess what? He won that election. I think it was 77 seats from memory. He won, Labor won 4 seats in WA. The coalition lost 5 because the fifth one went to Kate Chaney, the independent, and Anthony Albanese is Prime Minister today because of WA. That is quite a direct link. The thing is, in 2025, we had a landslide in the other direction. Does WA still hold this balance of power over the rest of the country? That's my question. And I do wonder, PK, Has enough changed now? Are there enough fiscal pressures and cost of living pressures on the East Coast where the government actually does now shift to this thing?
That's a great question. So this deal lasts till 2029. I think that you've got Buckley's chance of getting Albanese to change it before that date. But what this report does is frame the future. So these states that have been coming out lining up, you know, the South Australian Treasurer coming out saying the GST deal has been a dog of a deal, similar sentiments from Victoria and Queensland, New South Wales going hard. They have to build that story. The magic of WA, seriously, they've produced some political magic that's working to their advantage politically. I've denounced it, but it's certainly working, is that they've made their population care about it. Now, do you think the GST deal is noticed enough to be a vote switcher for people in New South Wales or Victoria? Absolutely not. There's just too much else going on, I think, probably because they are very different kind of places, right? And so to actually create a political pressure point that the federal government thinks, oh, goodness, there are votes to be lost in Victoria and New South Wales because of the way we distribute this, that's when you might get some pressure. That's not just about to happen. This has to be, the case has to be made and argued and won. And that's a long burn. Now, on your question of it's a different situation to when WA delivered Anthony Albanese basically the prime ministership in many ways, it is absolutely a different situation. I mean, he's got 94 seats. He has a whole different level of power than he did then. But he also has wall-to-wall politicians. Did you hear how quickly Andrew Hastie and Michaela Cash came out to sort of say, don't touch the GST deal? You can see why he would be cautious politically, not economically. Economically, the thing's a joke. But politically, to touch it. And the idea that, oh, we've got enough seats in other states, so it's not a problem. Actually, if you look at Labor's primary vote at the moment, I don't think Albanese is resting pretty. I don't think he is sort of wanting to burn more political capital over things like this. And also, he did make a promise. Don't forget. Now, I know his promises mean less than they used to since he broke the promises on negative gearing and capital gains, but he did make a promise that he wouldn't break the deal as well. So I don't think it's about to happen, but I do think the case is being made for why it should happen in the future. What's your view?
Look, my view is formed a little bit by some of the chats I've been having with the government, and I think you're right to say there's no immediate appetite to tear this thing up. I think some of the suspicion in WA is exactly what you just pointed to. The Prime Minister promised that he would not change capital gains tax, and then turns out he did. So that has opened a portal in the minds of many people in the West, which is he might say it, but he sometimes goes the opposite direction. So that's sort of a personal political credibility problem he has to address in the West. So that will continue to hang over this debate, I think. But you're right. I don't think there's a real appetite at this point in time to go there. But the government designed the terms of reference for this Productivity Commission report. It exists because it was part of the original 2018 deal that there would be a review. But the Treasurer wrote the terms of reference, and it has come up with a few bits and bobs that I think open the door for a proper debate. And one of them, for instance, is there's a sort of perverse outcome in the current arrangements where, because New South Wales is the benchmark as the most fiscally solid and diverse state, it's usually between New South Wales and Victoria, but sad to say, PK, Victoria doesn't have that status because it's got all sorts of fiscal problems. So New South Wales is the benchmark. Get this, according to the report, if there's a bushfire in New South Wales that costs hundreds of millions, billions of dollars, New South Wales decline, its capacity, fiscal strength gets hit. But because it's the benchmark, that means WA's GST share goes up as a result of a bushfire in New South Wales. So there are, you know, how that is in any way a public policy benefit or an intended design feature, you know, defies belief. But there you have it. So they've laid it out And again, I think it drives a wedge into this whole issue. And I think the other point, Pico, you're so right, that the other states have to make the argument.
Oh, yeah.
They have to make the argument.
And not just to the federal government. They've got to make it hurt for the federal government. You've got to be worried that you might lose a couple of seats in New South Wales if you don't address it. Because the reason WA has this power, that is, as I say, a bipartisan, multi-party power, is because of the fear. So there is no fear about the other states. That's the raw politics, and that's why it's just not happening yet.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think WA, the fear gets whipped up as well because it's, I mean, it's there's not as much sort of media diversity over there. You have a few very, very loud voices that tend to dominate the debate. And so, yeah, that's where we are.
That's where we're at. So let's talk about another fight, a fight that I must say I'm terribly confused about why the superannuation wars are being re-prosecuted, just on the sort of core numbers in terms of the support for this scheme. So, backstory, superannuation, a Keating government invention, something that really has been, I think, lauded around the world as building the collective and individual wealth of Australians as they go into retirement, a transformative policy. I'm not saying it's perfect, but it is. There is no dispute that it is quite transformative to the way we design our system. Superannuation is emerging as a major ideological battleground now. It has long been disliked, can I say, by the coalition, but because all smart politicians accept the writing on the wall, there has been what I would call a political ideological neutralisation of superannuation for the coalition, where they have radically accepted it as part of Australia's architecture and they have not said they're going to rip it down, right? One Nation leader, Pauline Hanson, has called for people to have early access to their superannuation to deal with the cost of living crisis. Now, this idea has been floated on News 24, formerly Sky, over the weekend. Barnaby Joyce has backed the idea on Sunrise this morning. Hanson's arguing that the rules should be lightened up a bit to allow people to dip into their retirement savings to help pay off their mortgages or help them with the cost of living. Now, this isn't her invention because we know that people like Andrew Bragg, for instance, is a coalition frontbencher who is very passionate about his dislike for superannuation that he thinks is basically industry superannuation funds that are union-backed and that it's a, you know, a Ponzi scheme. Really, that's my word, not his, but you know what I mean, that's been set up to help the Labor movement. Jim Chalmers told the Australian Financial Review the election would be in part a referendum on super. Now, why would Jim Chalmers want an election to be a superannuation referendum, Jacob? Put some sunlight on why that would benefit the Labor Party.
Oh, I think they see this as a tremendous opportunity to distinguish Labor support for one of the world's really most impressive and effective savings schemes. If you look elsewhere in the world, very few examples of this exist. It's a $4 trillion pool of wealth, and there are lots of problems with it. There are lots of issues with the distribution and who has most of it and who doesn't. Those are all fair points to debate. But I tell you what, if the country didn't have that sitting there, we would be in so much fiscal trouble right now. Now, I'm not saying governments tap super to fix their budgets, but it sits there. It's this ballast underneath the entire story of Australia's wealth. And it's a long-term play. It's not for short-term tinkering. The government will argue, bring it on. Let's have an election on super, because they will be feeling that every single Australian with super who watches their super will feel threatened by what Pauline Hanson and Andrew Bragg are suggesting, which is that it becomes something you use to just pay for your daily living costs rather than your retirement. I think they think they're on a winner with this.
They think, yeah. But you can see that their ideological kind of belief that and the sort of catch cry of the people who believe that super should be accessed for, you know, other things other than retirement is it's your money. So you should, you know, that individual rights thing, you know, you should be able to do whatever you want with it, right? Now,
I suspect there's a bit of an argument for around housing. because housing is also a form of stability for people.
Yeah, but already there's a debate inside the coalition of the super for housing part, which has been their policy now for a couple of elections, that should no longer be their policy. So, you know, already on the coalition side, they want to, and you know, one of the reasons for that, which is what the broader thing I want to go to, it would be inflationary. So let's use that argument for accessing your super early to deal with the cost of living crisis, okay? So I have super and I'm finding it hard to pay my bills and I want to dip into my super to spend more basically on the stuff that I need to. Is that not the actual definition, Jacob Greber, of inflation? Like, would I not be creating as an individual and then lots of little me's doing that? Wouldn't that be creating inflation? Am I? I don't know. Like, I was reasonable student at economics. Like, yeah, it sounds wild.
No, absolutely. And we did a bit of this. We've actually got an example of this in practice. During the COVID pandemic, people were able to access part of their super to get through that crisis. And there's been some very interesting research pointing out to how much that did add to economic demand in an economy and subsequently, you know, was not zero of the inflation that we've had since. Now, those folks spent that money. It's gone. They will need to make that up during the rest of their working lives, or they simply won't have the savings they otherwise would have, and they might end up then becoming a drag on the pension system, the old age system later in life. So, yeah, probably the long-term picture, you know, you can argue about it, but in the short term, you're absolutely right. That would stoke inflation. You'd suddenly give everyone, an ability to spend that money, and they would spend it. If you're pulling money out of super, you're doing it because you need it. The government's argument will be that support comes from other sources in other ways and is temporary.
Mm-hmm. Jane Hume, who is obviously the deputy leader of the Liberal Party, has already come out this morning and said Jim Chalmers is making things up. She can see the campaign coming at them, right? She can see it, can see the fire starting, and she's got the hose and she's like, oh no, I'm getting this fire down. I am not letting this one go up in flames. I understand why Andrew Bragg wants to be radical and come up with radical ideas. Obviously for Hanson, that's a different, yeah, there's different motives, but there are political risks.
Yeah, it's a bit like, you know, the work from home debate during the last election campaign that Jane Hume knows all too well.
Oh, she knows.
How that plays out. I think she can sense a similar trap here. So, yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised at all that Jim Chalmers is salivating at the chops at the thought that this will be a political fight.
Yeah, for sure. You know, another fight, but it's sort of a very hard to pick fight at this stage, like where the fighting will happen is in relation to the NDIS. That NDIS bill has entered the Senate for debate now, and that's after an inquiry report was tabled on Friday. The Greens, they are hard and fast and deeply opposed to this. The Green Senator Jordan Steele John has attempted to suspend standing orders to dump the bill. Of course, he was shut down. That's not going to happen. But the Greens have been pretty consistent in their opposition to all of this. The Chamber is now debating the substance of the legislation. The NDIS Minister, Jenny McAllister, said she was confident the bill would be passed. The Coalition is trying to make some improvements, but they are likely to say yes, aren't they, Jacob? That's the truth.
Look, the interests of both the major parties align here on what they're trying to do, which is put this back on what they're calling a sustainable footing. They're going to push some of the supports and services onto the states. The Thriving Kids program that's meant to start ramping up from October. There's really mixed messages coming out of the states about the level of readiness. I'm sure you've heard the same thing, Patricia. That there looks very messy. But in the short term, both sides of politics will be pushing to get this done. Jenny McAllister says she's confident, as you said. There will be some smaller issues. You've got the party rooms and caucus meeting tomorrow, which my understanding is will be when these things get signed off and then pushed through. So I have a feeling that this one is going to land. It will be problematic if it doesn't, because the timing then is it's pushed out and out and out. And the government, don't forget how much of the government's fiscal repair job, by which I mean those deficits that we talked about earlier in the conversation, there's a big chunk of it that comes from addressing the NDIS budget, which has been growing at double-digit numbers for years and years and years, and they want to get that down to the sort of growth that you have in Medicare as an equivalent.
Yeah, they need to do this. I'm not suggesting they need to do it in the exact form, because there are some issues in the legislation. People have raised fair issues with the legislation. But back to the thriving kids part, I mean, there is so much anxiety in some of those communities, as you know, Jacob. If you're a parent of a, you know, 10-year-old boy who has some developmental delays or some learning difficulties and you are freaking out about what might be available, that is not a small thing. And so there is a political cost here too. There's a political cost either way. If you don't do anything, the ballooning cost is obviously a huge problem. But equally, there is a political cost to letting down families, ordinary Australians who, you know, expect the state to provide decent supports for their kids that are struggling. And that's at the core of this.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything more politically challenging than taking entitlement away or taking something away from people that they currently have access to. That is so many magnitudes of difficulty harder than giving people those things in the first place. That's easy. It's the taking away.
All right. Well, it wouldn't be right to end a podcast without a conversation about polling. The Resolve poll is out, and it would be wrong not to talk about it, especially given Nicholas and his contribution to what we should call our pod today. Voters have condemned the Albanese government's handling of immigration policy in this latest poll. 54% agreeing the government is running the portfolio in an unplanned and unmanaged way. Now, could it be that Tony Burke, the Home Affairs Minister, who's been beavering away at an immigration policy that takes down the numbers and takes down the heat and the politics of this issue, might be slightly influenced, not directly by today's poll, I'm not claiming that, but broadly the mood, which is that this is a problem for the government.
I thought you were going to say polls come and go, but they always arrive on Monday, PK.
That's true.
Yeah, look, the government is addressing immigration because of, for instance, that number. There is deep concern in the community. The political opponents to the right of Labor are whipping up the immigration issue. They talk about it constantly. And a lot of people agree with what some of those politicians are saying. So the government is acutely aware that it cannot simply ignore the issue. The numbers are too high in the view of many, many people. The other person that looms large over all of this in the Prime Minister's consciousness is Keir Starmer, who one of the reasons he's no longer Prime Minister of Great Britain is because he failed to recognise how potent the immigration issue is. The Prime Minister, our Prime Minister, is acutely aware of that, never forgets it. So, yeah, I think when Tony Burke eventually does outline what he's going to do, my mail is that's unlikely this week. Perhaps next week. We're probably hearing similar things. It will have some tough stuff in it. There's no other way to get the numbers down to the sorts of levels people are talking about without some very, very challenging conversations and decisions around who gets to come.
Yeah, and that's always going to be divisive among the Labor base. Some particularly kind of more left-leaning Labor people will think that they are jumping to the tune of One Nation and the anti-immigration forces too much. Of course, there'll be grievance in some communities about, you know, especially touching the family reunion numbers. But don't think that there is no trouble on the other side here. This is not a settled issue in the right-wing side of politics either. Look at the coalition at the moment. They're essentially having internal and very external, I've got to say, dispute about backpacker numbers. Now, if you're a Nationals MP, you want those people, backpackers and others who do a lot of the labour on farms and other places, to come to Australia. But if you want to drive down immigration numbers as much as someone like Andrew Bragg is saying they should, then you need to look at all categories, including backpacker numbers, right, Jacob?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, Bragg says he was doing his own numbers on what it would take to get immigration to the sort of right levels. And he talked about net overseas migration of about 180,000 per year. Remember, Angus Taylor's policy, which he announced in his budget reply in May, was to link the annual net overseas migration number to housing completions. Now, that has all sorts of technical issues associated with it. But last year, we, I think, completed something like 170,000 houses. So actually, the number would be lower than what Andrew Bragg is suggesting. It might be 160 or 150 or 170. Now, that to get that number, to create that number, you're going to have to be very dramatic in some other areas, like family reunions, potentially. And then sitting off in the wings is One Nation suggesting a figure of 130. Now, I think that's for permanent migration. I don't think that's NOM. It's technical, but her NOM, if she had her way, would be very, very low, like potentially even negative, according to some of the people I've been talking to who understand this space. And that's never really occurred and would be quite impactful on our economy. And you think about the backpackers and you think about every time you travel west, if you're on the East Coast, north, if you're in Adelaide, east, if you're in Perth, south, if you're in Darwin, to anywhere in the bush, anywhere regional, every single hotel, pub, petrol station, restaurant is staffed by people who are visiting on these visas. So I can't even imagine what effect that would have across regional and rural Australia.
Yeah, I think it would be seismic, right? And this is why they're having the debate. So while Labor's got and problems around immigration, they're also the government. So they're always going to be held to account more, as they should be. If you want government, you're going to be held to account more. They're in charge. They're in charge of the program. They don't just have to have hot takes on the program, but it just shows that the fault lines are much more complex than just a kind of in and out, you know, and then the regional issues too. There are some states that are desperate for immigrants, and then places like Sydney and Melbourne where it's obviously felt a lot for some people, and they're expressing that in all surveys, making it quite clear, and Labor has to provide certainty around what they're doing, and perhaps I think the lack of urgency around doing it, like I think it's taken a bit of time to get to this and still we don't have an announcement, might be a problem for them. Like time does matter, you know, lack of urgency.
It's like what we said last week, isn't it? The longer this goes, the bigger the vacuum, the more people fill it with all kinds of speculation and that's not helpful.
Politics being filled by others, you know, you want to be in charge of the narrative. You don't want to be responding to other people's narratives. And the problem at the moment on immigration is that Labor looks like it's responding to the narratives set by others, mainly a woman called Pauline Hanson. That's it for Politics Now today. Jacob, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks, PK.
And Claudia Long will join me tomorrow for the latest developments. And if you have a question for us, send a short voice note to thepartyroom@abc.net.au. And we'll answer it. Bye, Jacob.
See you later.